So we'll just see how it goes. And also we're coming up to our range retreat, so that's when the monks don't come up here. So I'll probably forget anyway if you do any more requests. But this was a request from someone. I'm trying to sort of work through them. Who says that at work they're having to deal with difficult people. And can you please, desperately, Ajahn Brahm, can you please give a talk on how to deal with difficult people? Oh, I'm not sure, where are the difficult people? I see in front of me here just wonderful, beautiful, peaceful people. Because I've been told when you're in the temple you always behave, but when you go back home or go to work, some of you are totally different people. That's the nature of people sometimes. But it is something which causes us a lot of mental pain in our world, a lot of stress and anxiety. When in our life, at work, at home or somewhere, we have to deal with difficult people. And how can we actually deal with these? And first of all, applying Buddhist principles to this problem, that you're never going to escape from difficult people. Difficult people are part of life. Even I thought that going to become a monk, I'd only live with enlightened people, but unfortunately not all monks are enlightened. At least they don't start off that way. And some of them are very, very hard to live with. And in fact, as a senior monk, we used to sort of get these letters every now and again from other monasteries saying, we've got this monk. And they say, well, you know, he likes solitude, which was code for he can't get on with anybody. Or he's a very good worker, which meant he can't meditate for his life. Or that he's very reflective and contemplative, which means he's always looking at other people's faults and telling them. So we always had these code words. So usually if they would say they want to send a monk over from another monastery, we'd always actually ring up, not the abbot, but ring up one of the other monks to find out what the heck they were sending to make sure that it wasn't going to be someone who's going to be a troublemaker. But you could somehow control the troublemakers coming in to your monastery, to your business or your family sometimes, but sometimes when you're born with them, they're your family or you ordain them, or they just rock up at your monastery or they rock up into your life. What can you do about it? So, you know, it is a problem that each one of us from time to time has to deal with so-called difficult people. So how can we deal with this? Number one, acceptance. The difficult people are part of life. So instead of getting this mental, I don't want this, this is wrong, I don't know why I have to deal with this, why me? Instead of that sort of negativity which makes it more difficult, sometimes we just learn to live with difficult people. I always remember just when I was young, there wasn't many books on spirituality, but I remember an old and ancient almost spiritual teacher who was used to live in France, I think, just after between the First and Second World War, I think just after the Second World War, he was still around, called Gurdjieff. If any of you know him, you may know him because his most famous book was called Meetings with Remarkable Men. And that became a very catchy title, and people have used that title for many, many other little books. But Meetings with Remarkable Men was his spiritual journey. But what really caught my attention was that after he died, that when people were going through his papers of this little community, a spiritual community he used to run in France somewhere, they found that one of these people in the community who was just the real troublemaker, someone who was just so difficult to live with. And all the other members of this spiritual community would sometimes complain to this Gurdjieff fellow, saying, look, he's just a pain in the backside, can't you please tell him to leave? And he'd say, no, just learn from this, learn how to be patient and to have a wider, more compassionate mind. And everybody would complain about this guy, but the leader, this Gurdjieff, would never get rid of him. Until actually, when they looked at his papers after he died, they found he was the only member of that community who Gurdjieff was paying to stay there. He actually paid this troublemaker to actually to stir his community, to actually to teach all the people in his community just how to be more tolerant. Because it's very easy to be tolerant with nice people, with kind people. But learning tolerance with difficult people, now that's a real struggle. That's a challenge. That's how we can really learn. Because if we can learn a little bit of tolerance with difficult people, we may learn a little bit of tolerance with the other difficulties in life, such as our sicknesses, such as old age, such as disappointment, stock market going down, football team losing, and all these other difficulties we have to deal with in life, because life is difficult. So people will be difficult, so we have to learn from it. So number one, remember that no matter what you do, no matter where you go, no matter how much you try and struggle, there will always be difficult people to deal with. So welcome to this world. This is not heaven. So what's somebody, this is a nice little joke about this person. This is actually fits in over here. This person died and he was born, all right, reappeared, sitting in this wonderful now armchair, like one of these lazy boys with his foot out, and it's very nice and soft and comfortable. And he was sitting in the armchair, just having nice. He said, "This is really good. This is a very nice place to be reborn. It's so comfortable here." But you know, after a few hours, and it started getting a bit sort of sore, and after a couple of days, you know, it was getting sort of a bit much, just sitting in the same armchair for a couple of days. And this person came along. And this man said, "Well, you know, this is all very well here in heaven, just sitting in this armchair, but can't I sit somewhere else sometimes?" And the man said, "What do you mean this is heaven?" He thought he was in heaven. He thought this was supposed to be nice. But this is not the case. All things are troublesome. Even the most comfortable armchair, if you stay in there long enough, it becomes troublesome. So it's welcome to the nature of life. It's troublesome. So people are going to be troublesome, but nevertheless, we always want something to do to see if we cannot eliminate the troublesomeness of life, but at least lessen it somehow. And there is a way of doing that. So a lot of times, if I just say, well, you know, life is suffering, first noble truth, they feel very, very well, we know that already. We don't come to Dhammaloka Center on a Friday night to be told what we already know. We want to know, Ajahn Brahm, how to deal with this, how to lessen it. Please help us. And so number one, sometimes just the way we arrange our lives, the way we arrange our families, the way we order our business or place of work or our monasteries, some of those things can engender troublesome people. Now, over in our monastery, it's just been, we had a little psychology experiment which was going around, you know, some sort of paper which we were reading, which was very fascinating. It was a cookie experiment. If those of you who know the cookie experiment, it was actually quite revealing about the nature of human beings and what happens when they get into positions of authority. As you all know, a lot of troublesome people are those in positions of authority who boss you around and bully you. And of course, psychology experiments are very revealing because they take ordinary people and see what they do in special situations. And ordinary situations which reveal some of the nature of the human being. Not just special human beings, not failed human beings, but ordinary human beings. Because what they did, they had these volunteers and they split them into groups of three. And they gave each of these little teams sort of a little job and a report to write out. And two of the three were tasked with writing the report out, and the third was supposed to check them. And that sort is to check to make sure they wrote the report properly. So that third person was tacitly in a position of authority. And the main part of the experiment was when they brought a plate of cookies and some coffee in, because it was hard work. They didn't realize that this was actually the main part of the experiment. It wasn't just a treat. Because they brought, like, what was it, five cookies in. There's only three people there. And apparently, Western psychology means that no one ever takes the last cookie. That's a no-no. But it was the fourth cookie which was the interesting one. Who would take the fourth cookie? And that would always be the person who is checking everybody else. The supervisor, the one in authority, they would always think that they deserved that fourth cookie. And the other interesting thing was when they ate those two cookies, while everyone else ate one, they would spill all sorts of cookie chips all over the place. They would have no proper sort of etiquette in eating. Because it was realized that for them, in positions of authority, rules did not apply to them. And they deserved more than anybody else. And I think you recognize what we're talking about here. Whenever anybody is put in a position of authority, number one, we think we deserve more than anybody else. That we deserve that fourth cookie. And number two, that the rules, yeah, they apply to others, but not to me. Now this is where we get the problems with authorities. And it does make it difficult. You know what I'm talking about? It's unfair. They get more. They think they deserve more. And they give you the rules, but they don't keep the rules themselves. Now that is, it's a great little experiment. Oh, the other thing which was in that experiment, apparently those people in authority thought they knew everything which was going on. Whereas we all know that sometimes people in authority, they know very little of what's going on, but they're always delusional. They think they know more than they actually do know. And now this is one of the problems with authority, and that is a lot of times we get the difficulties, both at work and in relationships, when one person assumes that authority position. Now it's great, it's very freeing, and it was very relieving for me to find out, when I started investigating Buddhism, how authority worked in Buddhism. Because monasteries, it's like organizations, it's communities, it's like a little company. But there's one thing in a monastery which I was very impressed with, was it was democratically run. Yeah, I'm titular the abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery. But as the other monks would let you know that whenever we have a meeting, my vote counts exactly the same as any other monk's vote. It is a democratic system with one monk, one vote. And very often I do get outvoted. So my authority is very, very limited. In fact, it's basically not much more than any other monk. Obviously, because I've been there the longest, you do get a little bit more respect, but not always. And sometimes you're outvoted. So the authority is not that strong in a monastery. Now that's actually how it should be. That's how it was set up by the Buddha. Because this Buddha was an incredibly wise person who really wanted to make sure that this community of monks, community of nuns, could live peaceful and harmoniously. And he did adopt a democratic model. Not a monarchist model where there was one person on top telling everyone else to do. Because like in the great wisdom of a compassionate, sort of enlightened one, you realize such authority, you know, will create too many problems and will sort of stop that lack of peace and kindness and love developing in the community. So understanding that authority, power does corrupt, but how it corrupts is it just, it's almost genetic, it's sort of culturally embedded in us. Now from all cultures, I think everybody is the same. Once you get people in positions of authority, they can become very difficult people to live with. But if we have like a shared authority, sort of a communal, a democracy, where we don't think about ourselves, but we think about us, we think about the monastery. It's not about me, it's not about you, it's always about us. It's about the family. I'm not in charge, we are in charge. And when you have that sort of sense of real democracy and us, not sort of, you know, a me and you, then I think that a lot of that difficulties can actually be overcome. So first of all, one of the great ways of overcoming the difficult relationships people have and how we sort of see that as difficult people is trying to arrange sort of, you know, the government governing structure of a sort of a company, of an office, or of a family, certainly of a monastery, to have less authority figures. And there's this more sense of like a community working together. Not a person in front and a person behind, but people walking side by side. Now that would actually help a lot with solving the difficult people in this world, because when you're not in a position of authority or in a position of inferiority, many of those difficulties disappear. So if you're having some problems in your family, one person is difficult, or you think both of you are difficult, look at sort of this authority structure. Who actually, you know, makes the decisions? Who's actually in control? And this is going to be part of the cause of that difficulty there. So see if you can actually just stop being the person who always gives the orders. Stop thinking that, you know, you are in charge, or you're the best, or you're the person who has to take control. And have a little bit of cooperation and working together. And especially sort of in an office or in a company. It doesn't matter if a person is, you know, is the CEO or does the most work. It doesn't matter, because we all have to work together, and that's the most important. Certainly in a monastic system, you make sure that, you know, you don't always just have the easy jobs. I make sure I do go out in the rain and work sometimes, and, you know, just like everybody else. So you're not sort of set apart. So that particular structure is one of the ways of overcoming difficulties with people. But number two, that, you know, sometimes we try and avoid those difficulties, but this is life, it's not perfect, and you do meet difficult people. So how can you deal with that? Not avoiding it, but when it's right in your face. And of course, one of the first things is to look at the error in even thinking they're a difficult person. They're not a difficult person. There's no such thing as difficult people. There are people who make life difficult. They're not difficult people. People who make life difficult. Now, I know I emphasize this because it's a very important point. I mentioned this in the talk which I gave at Armidale. They were asking me that, you know, how I deal with people when you go into prisons. And I've met some really notorious criminals. But I keep on saying that in all the time I've been visiting prisons, I never once met a thief, a murderer. I've never met a criminal. All I've ever met is a person who'd made a crime. Now, that whole attitude, you might think that's, oh, that's just being sort of pedantic, that's just splitting hairs. It's not splitting hairs. It changes your whole perception of what's going on. If you see it going to a prison, you see that's a prisoner, that's a thief, that's a murderer, that's a rapist, then you relate to that sort of that crime, and you miss all the other stuff in that person. And when you miss the other stuff in that person, it means all that person ever presents to you, what you're looking for is that criminal behavior. In the same way that if you see someone, you say they're a difficult person, all you'll ever see is their difficult behavior, that's all you remember, and you encourage that difficult behavior because that's actually what you see. But if you go into a prison and say, that's a person who's done a murder, you see they're far, far bigger than that terrible act which they did. You see that person sort of who's thieved, who's stolen stuff. They're far bigger than those acts. And when you actually start to see that other side of them, which is far bigger, that's actually what they show you back. You're respecting another part of them, the good part of them, the respectable part of them, and they start to see that themselves. They gain that self-esteem. They like that part of them rather than the criminal part of them, and the criminal part of them just gets blown away. Because what we like, what we focus on, usually grows. And that's the same with looking at a person. So if ever you see someone in your office at your home, and that idea comes up, they're a difficult person, please may the alarm bells ring, may the red flag go up. You're actually creating the problem by the way you perceive it. They are a difficult person. Change the perception. They are a person who makes difficulty. So you see, they're much bigger than those stupid acts which cause you so much suffering and pain. When you see the other part of them, you can focus on that other part of them, the good part of them, the kind part of them, because there's no such being anywhere in this universe, never has been, never will be, a person who's totally bad, evil, hopeless, who's never fun to be with sometimes. People sometimes come here and they're just going through a divorce, and they tell me all the rotten things about their partner. And I've known their partner, and they're really nice Buddhists. They come here, and they're kind, they have good fun together, they tell good jokes. And I just wonder, I mean, what's going on here? And the reason is because they've got, everyone's got those two parts to them, the beautiful, the kind, the generous, the fun part of them. They've got the negative part of them. And sometimes when you're going through divorces, that's all you see, the negative part of them. And, you know, they come here, and, you know, they're your friend, and they're not getting divorced from me. That's why I became a monk, so I don't have to go through that sort of stuff. But anyway, they don't have to go through it with me, so I should see the beautiful side of them. But the thing is, both sides are there. But if you're going through a divorce and all you see is that sort of terrible side of the other person, that's the only side they're going to show you back. And of course you know that. And that's why when I see the beautiful side of them, that's what they show me back. Now look, what type of life do you want to have? Do you want to have that sort of that negative part of life, that terrible part where you see the difficulty in other people and they just show it back to you and then you just get into this terrible, painful, rotten way of living? You don't have to do that. There is an alternative. You see the other side of them. And it's amazing what happens if you can do that. Now, because I've been a Buddhist a long time, because I've learned my meditation, I notice how this mind works. It's great when you can do this because you find people. And sometimes they say, how on earth, Ajahn Brahm, can you actually stand with a person like that? They're just such an awful person to be with. I say, yeah, I can still be their friend. I remember this one lady who used to ring up, and she would swear down the phone. She would say, I'm going to come with an M16, I'm going to sort of shoot all you monks. You know, and quite a few F words and B words and all sorts of other words. I said, oh yeah, I can, you must be having a really terrible day today. And I would actually calm her down. And after a while, you know, she would actually always be ringing me. Because I was the only one who could really understand her. Well, I was understanding she had a very painful, difficult life. And just all this stuff was coming out from her because, you know, she just needed to vent. She needed to unwind. It was just so painful inside of you that they just wanted to have it come out. And after about 10 or 15 minutes, had a wonderful conversation. Simply because, you know, I wasn't going to see the difficulty, I was seeing the other part of her. And eventually that's what she showed me. There's this other guy who, oh, many years ago I remember him, he was fell off a roof. And he sort of, he went crazy. He dressed up as Elvis Presley. And he was really, was out of his mind. And he'd come up to our centre, the previous centre in Magnolia Street. I remember him coming up there because he fell off, he had a walking stick. And he wanted to talk to me. And as he was talking to me, he was swishing this walking stick just over my head and past my ears. He was attacking me. But he'd always miss. He's a very good aim, thank goodness. Because he never meant to hit me, he just meant to just not just test me out, but to take out his pain. And he would just calm down after a while, and I could have a really good chat with him. He just realized he was a very, very difficult person to deal with. But he wasn't a difficult person, he was a person with difficulty, and I could sort of see that and allow the other part to shine forth. Now this is something which is a tough one to do, but if that difficult person is in your family and you can't sort of leave them, you can't get away, then look at them. They're not a difficult person, they're a person with difficulties. So have a look at that and see if you can see another part of them. And sometimes you'll be so surprised at what you can do with such a person. This, I told this story in Opening the Door of Your Heart, but it's one of the most moving ones. I'll have to give this a rider, because when I wrote this in my book and it was published in the United States, a few people said, look, Ajahn Brahm, you should actually say something more about this story, because it's about domestic violence. This was a woman who had a violent husband here in Perth. And when she came to see me once, she just came, she'd been coming for many years, sitting in the back, you saw her in the back, but she never came to speak with me. And this was the first time she really came to speak with me. And she said, I just want to come and say thank you for all these teachings that you and all the other monks, we didn't have nuns then, all these people who have given all these talks over the last 7 years I've been coming here, I've come to thank you. And I always want to say, why? What's happened? And then she said, that when she first started coming to our Buddhist center, she said she was not a Buddhist. She was not interested in meditation. She said the only reason she came was because her husband was beating her. And 2 hours in the Buddhist center was 2 hours when she was safe from that violence. That was intense. Now this was many years ago, maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And the time when domestic violence was there, and no one was really treating it. You didn't have the refuges, you didn't have the sort of the police to go to. And she said, and I don't encourage this, I don't advise this, this was a special lady who did something very miraculous, which I don't know how many people could do, and it's a dangerous thing to do, I wouldn't advise it, but this is what she did. She said when she came, she heard a teaching, we call it positive forgiveness, to let go of all the pain which she was experiencing. To let that go, to forgive it. Now sometimes we talk about forgiveness and sometimes people don't realize just how powerful and deep forgiveness is in Buddhism. It is deeper than an ocean. It has got no bottom to it, forgiveness. As a Buddhist, you can forgive absolutely anything, which is quite amazing to really understand. And when you see how other people do that, how they forgive just things which many people think unforgivable, but they do forgive it, that becomes so inspiring. It gives hope for everybody. But anyway, the forgiveness is total, deep. But it's not good enough. As many people rightly say, if you forgive them, it'll keep going on. You can't keep enduring that. But it was the other part of forgiveness which he heard here, which I've just been explaining to you today. The teachings don't change that much over the 27 years I've been here. As many of you know, the jokes, well, they don't change either, but they do every now and again. But anyway, the positive side of that forgiveness was focusing on the other side of her husband, not the violent side. Because he wasn't a violent man. He was a man who was doing violence. There was something more to him than that sort of violent part. And she actually focused on that. And she reinforced that whenever he didn't hit her. She was very kind and nice to him. She gave him some reinforcement. And she told me it took 7 years. 7 years, and she totally changed that man around. And I remember him coming to our monastery and just see the beautiful relationship the two of them had together, and they had a couple of kids as well. The violence had gone. And instead, she had made this monster into an angel. And I would never forget her smile. You know that sometimes people smile and it's fake. This was a smile of an angel. Someone who had done something very, very rare and very, very difficult. She changed a violent man into being a beautiful, loving husband. And she deserves every piece of happiness from her relationship. She really was compassionate. The obvious thing to do is to run away, to go somewhere else. And again, that's what you would advise most people. But for her, she said, no, I'm going to do something, change this difficult person. And it worked. She managed that. It can be done. That's an extreme. But all it means is you don't look upon them as a difficult person, or a person with difficulty, so you can actually see something more. But it's so tough sometimes to bear. One of the reasons why it's hard to do that, and the next part of learning how to deal with difficult people, is because we allow their difficult behavior to actually create more pain than is necessary. And of course what that is when we have an unpleasant experience, people bully us, they shout at us, they mistreat us, and we cherish that inside of us. We actually keep the bad memories. And it's one of the most ridiculous things of a human being that we keep recalling the painful experiences. That what they did to us. Now, we've heard this before. It's very simple, but very accurate. If someone calls you a pig, what do most people do? They keep reflecting on that. She called me a pig. She's got no right to call me a pig. Why did she call me a pig? And a wise person realizes you've just allowed her to call you a pig 3 more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you a pig 1 more time. And what's what most people do? They keep remembering and recalling it. They're allowing that person to continue hurting you. Now that's just one example, calling you a pig. Letting you down, even hitting you, bullying you, giving you more work, shouting at you. Wouldn't it be wise to let them shout at you once, and only once, so they can't hurt you many more times? So the difficult person, or the person creating difficulties, is limited to the damage which they cause to your happiness and well-being. Now you can do that. And that's a beautiful trick to do. Because what it means is, yeah, there will be difficult people or people with difficulties. There will be pain in life. But you don't add more than is absolutely necessary by keeping on dwelling upon the painful part of life and even cherishing that pain. Why can't we let it go? I tell you why you can't let it go. Because you haven't been trained, you haven't been encouraged. So often what happens when you meet your friends, you tell about, oh, what this person did or what the boss did. We actually cherish sort of all the bad memories. And we repeat them to each other and we get reinforcement from it. Oh, you poor thing, it's a terrible thing. Why don't you change your job? Why don't you get a divorce? I know a nice lawyer. You shouldn't stand for that. You know, there's being bullied, it's bullying at work. You can actually get some compensation for that. You shouldn't have to deal with that. And why isn't it we can't say just drop it? Let it go. And don't allow those painful moments of the past to create more harm than is necessary. It's beautiful when you can do that. And of course, and as a monk, I get my fair share of criticism. There's no one in this world who doesn't get criticized. But at least I know just to let it go. Immediately. As soon as you've heard it. Gone. Now what that actually also does, it means not only does it keep you in a greater sense of peace and happiness and freedom, but also it discourages other people from acting in such a antisocial, dysfunctional way. Because if you really get upset when someone calls you a pig, then they're going to call you a pig again and again and again. They find what they call your buttons and they're going to keep pressing them. So why do you always allow yourself to actually to be controlled by other people's stupid behavior? It's one of my sayings, and one of the famous sayings, and I love this saying. I will never allow anyone to control my happiness. Happiness is under my power, under my jurisdiction, and you're not going to spoil my day by calling me the most stupid, ugliest, fat monk you've ever heard. What was it, the other last week? I think Dennis was bringing a couple of his friends. No, it wasn't Dennis. Somebody else bringing a couple of his friends. One was from Japan. They saw me and they started rubbing my belly. I think they were going to buy a lottery ticket next week. I don't know. But you don't get offended by anything. I tell people, look, of all the people in the whole world, religious people should be the hardest to offend. Instead of the easiest, the first to offend. And we've a really weird thing. We can't offend religion. We can't criticize religion. We can't sort of draw cartoons of religious figures. Look, of all the people in this world, religious people, because we're supposed to be peaceful. We're supposed to be kind and compassionate and tolerant. We're supposed to teach other people these things. We can't behave tolerant and compassionate ourselves, then we're a hypocrite. So we should be the hardest people to offend. So, try and offend me. I challenge you to spoil my day. People have tried that, and I find it hilarious. Sometimes you burst out laughing. What was it that one time Again, years and years ago when I first came here to Perth. Again, this was the old centre we had in Magnolia Street, North Perth. One day we should have a sign up here. The Buddhist Society of Western Australia started here. But anyway, these were the days when we were building our monastery in Serpentine. And so we'd actually, we'd come here for the weekend, and early Monday morning, about 4 o'clock, we'd load up the evening before. Loading up, we had this big old VW bus. It's amazing what you can get in the back of one of those. And so we had all our building material, and we'd take it down to Serpentine, and we'd work like dogs all week, and then come back here on into town for the weekend. And one day I was loading up all this stuff in the back of the car, and this girl came out. She's about 13 years of age, and she saw me in my robes. Now, this was about 26 years ago, when people didn't really know what monks were. And she looked at me. She had her hands on her hips and looked me up and down with utter disgust. I don't know where she learned that facial expression, but it was pretty neat. And out of disgust, and looked at me and said, "You're dressed like a girl. That's sick. Yuck." I'm afraid I just can't do it the way she said it, but it was just so disgusting, and she really meant it, like only a 13-year-old girl can do. And she was really trying to offend me. And I just burst out laughing. It was one of the funniest things I'd seen all week. And I think I remembered that and wrote about it in my book. And I just, no way am I going to get upset by things like that. I think it's actually funny. So people try and offend you, but no, I'm not going to be offended. What was that other time? This is a great story, a golden oldie. Going down the Leech Highway, you know, in that old bus a long time ago. Leech Highway is a wide road, I think 3 lanes on either direction. Came to the red traffic lights. It was a hot day in the summer. Not like today, it's winter time here and cold. A really hot day, maybe in the high 30s, and so no aircon. So got the windows rolled down. We came to the red light. I was in the passenger seat, okay, open window. And this group of kids, you know, maybe 19 or 20, you know, in a sort of an old beat-up old car, having a good time, they saw there was monks in the car. You know, monks. They knew what monks were anyway. They were all celibate. So one of them sort of got in the back, and they were just pointing at something and laughing at me with their mouths open. Ah! And I looked what they were looking, what they were trying to show me, because we're right next to each other, okay? Maybe about sort of, you know, 2 foot, no, between me and the sort of the driver. Look, copy of Playboy. So they knew I was a monk. Said, "Have a look, copy of Playboy." I thought it was really funny, because if I was a 19-year-old, I'd have done that if I'd have seen a monk. They were just having a good time, that's all. But they were trying to get me offended, but I just burst out laughing, and they laughed back, bye-bye, and off we went. But if they would have got offended, they would have won. And they think, oh, these monks, they're stupid, like everybody else. But when you just laugh, or when you just don't take offence, then people won't create any difficulty for you anymore. There's not much point. You might as well go shouting at a mountain, or trying to sort of kick a stone, you just hurt your own foot. So it's wonderful when you have this presence of mind, inability to get offended, and just letting go of things, and just, well, whatever people say or do, that's their karma, nothing to do with me. And they just leave you alone after a while. Again, early years as a monk, there was one of these monks who was a monk who created so much trouble for other people. He didn't have hardly any friends. And now I think he lives alone. I remember this particular time. Again, I was just a young monk. He was only 2 or 3 years senior to me. And I remember this occasion. We were washing our bowls. This was in our monastery in Thailand. Very traditional, very simple. And not only did we have a bowl, but if you ever go to our monastery, we have a little spittoon. Now, one of these things that I've got here. We always have a spittoon. You put sort of pieces of paper or just wash out your glass or something, always next to you. And I was cleaning up my spittoon, and I was just using sort of the same cloth I used in my bowl. Like we'd always done for ever since I went to that monastery. Standard procedure. All the other monks were doing it. But this monk came up to me and said, "Brahma Wangsa, that's a filthy habit. What are you doing that for?" Again, I can't really do this sort of angry stuff. I really do try my hardest to try and sort of, you know, be angry, but it's not in my repertoire. But he was really angry at me. Blama Wangsa, what are you doing? Filthy habit. And it was an amazing moment, which I'll never forget, because all the other monks, they stopped and looked. Because, you know, there's not much excitement in a monastery. So when you have moments like this, you know, you make the most of them. So they always looked at me, and what was going to happen next? And he was glaring down at me, this monk. I was on the ground, he was standing up. And I had enough presence of mind to say sorry. And I walked over to this basket containing old rags. Now I must admit, that took all of my willpower, because what I really wanted to do was to sock him one. Just the arrogant, unfair, why pick on me? You know, what are you doing that for? That's not what a monk should behave like. That's what how I felt. But I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I walked over to the rag bag. And it was rag basket. I knew, even though I was focused on the rag basket, I could feel all the eyes of all the monks follow me as I picked up the rag. And follow me as I walked back and started wiping my spittoon with this old rag, just like this monk had asked me. And then I looked at him, and all the other monks looked at him. He went bright purple. He was so embarrassed, and he just walked away. And he never got angry at me again. Ever. Because he knew I wasn't going to play. What's the point of getting angry at someone who's not going to get upset? Because that's why people try and make life difficult for you. They want to harm you. They want to hurt you. They want to take away your happiness, your peace, your freedom. I was rebellious. I would not allow that to happen. Yeah, you can shout at me, you can do all these things, but I'm not going to allow you to control my happiness. If you have the courage and the strength to do that, you'll find they'll start leaving you alone. You're no fun to play with anymore. You've got no buttons. No one can really upset you. So you should go and try and pick on somebody else. But at least that's something which you can do. Now, of course, that's just protecting you. But that person is creating that difficulty there. What are you going to do with them? And a lot of times you realize that, my goodness, if they're say such things to me and act in such a harmful, insensitive way to me, they'll do that to other people as well. Don't think that you're special, they just pick on you. Because you usually find that such people, they behave in the same way to others. And they will never, ever have many friends in life. They never have a good relationship, because if they have a wife, a husband, they'll just pick on them as well. Kids won't respect them. But even worse, one thing you know as a monk, meditating for a long time, the way you relate to others is precisely the way you relate to yourself. If you're kind and friendly to others, you'll be kind and friendly to yourself. And if you're just such a nasty person to other people, you'll be nasty to yourself as well. You know what I mean? Just when you're alone, how you look at yourself, how you criticize yourself, how you get down upon yourself, how you beat yourself up. That self-anger, you can see the degree of the self-anger reflected in the way you're angry at others. And if you're difficult to others, you'll have a huge amount of difficulty living with yourself. You won't have much peace or happiness. Yeah, you may be wealthy, you may be rich, you may have lots and lots of things, but you're not happy. You know that. The way you treat others is the way you treat yourself. I know it's supposed to be the golden rule, you know, treat other people as you'd want yourself to be treated. It's not really a choice. You do that. How you treat others is how you treat yourself. How you treat yourself is how you treat others. It's just human nature that way. So whenever I see a person acting so much like a sort of a bad person, I'm trying to sort of restrain my language. Because I know I was brought up and as a young person, I know how people speak. I was going to talk in A-S-S-H-O-L-E. If someone is like that, the way they're sort of... I didn't say it, okay. I did something straight. If someone behaves like that, now, that's how they behave to themselves. I know that. So when I see someone behaving like that, I think, my goodness, just what a terrible life they must have. And as somebody said a long time ago, I thought it was a great saying, look, I only have to deal with them just for a short period of time. Maybe, you know, an hour a day, or maybe at work, 8 hours a day, just 5 days a week. That's the only time I have to put up with them. But they have to put up with themselves 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of their life. And when I see that, they have to put up with themselves, you know, all the time, that's where I get this incredible compassion. Is that how you treat me? How are you treating yourself? You poor thing. And won't you have compassion? I mean real compassion, not playing around, but you see why you have compassion. Because if they hurt you, they're hurting themselves 10 times more than they hurt you. How can you stand that, you poor thing? And straight away you don't think of yourself anymore, because their pain is far greater than anything they visit on you. When I see that their pain is far greater than any pain which I may feel, compassion comes. And when you start showing them real kindness and compassion, it triggers something in them. They give you hurt, and you give them back kindness. Which one's going to win? It always, always is compassion wins. It's amazing just how it works. One of my favorite stories. This is the grunting prison officer story. Years and years ago, when I haven't really changed the basics of the way I teach. I was teaching in prison over in, I don't mind saying it now, Carnot Prison Farm, just up the road from our monastery, many years ago, so the people have all left now, so the people involved, you know, wouldn't sort of be offended. And I asked told one of the prisoners about this sort of kindness. You know, difficult people, just give them kindness, it works. They said, no way. They say, look, you know, we respect you, we like you, Ajahn Brahm, but look, you're not living in the real world. In the real world, if you give kindness to some, you know, these idiots, they'll just take advantage of you. And I was always up for a challenge. And I said, okay, look, let's test this out. I was a scientist before. How might all these things are evidence-based. They have to actually work. Otherwise, I wouldn't teach them. I wouldn't sort of go putting all these theories on you, making your life difficult, if I didn't know they actually work. So I said, okay, let's have a test. And I asked this guy, who is the most difficult person in this whole prison? And actually asked one person, they all agreed. It was this prison officer, one of the senior officers who worked in the admin building. And they say, he's a dog. In those days, that was actually quite sort of restraining them, saying he's a dog. And they gave me an example. They said, look, this happened last week. Shows you what sort of person this is. One of the guys in prison here. You know, this is incarnate. It's a long way away. There's no public transport up to that part of the world. And he said his wife managed to get someone to give her a lift to go and visit him. Hadn't seen his wife about 3 months, you know, because of transport difficulties. Now she managed to get a lift with someone. And she turned up at the prison, the visitors, and chimed in. You know, what's your name? Give us your ID. Who do you want to visit? And this senior officer saw that this prisoner's wife had come for a very, very rare visit. And while she's being sort of processed, he found that prisoner and sent him to the other side of the farm, about 2 kilometres away, on an errand where the PA system wouldn't reach. So after she checked in, the announcement came out with prisoner so-and-so, please go to the visitor's area, you have a visit. He didn't respond, because he was out of hearing. When they finally went to find him, I'm terribly sorry, visiting hours are over, better luck next time. And this prison officer did this just out of spite. Now not all prison officers are like that, many of them are really great guys, they come to our monastery. But there's always one or two who really, really sort of, don't know where they sort of get their mind from. Really mean, spiteful and unnecessary. And so they all called him this dog. So I said, great, we have our candidate, our victim, if you like. Now, do any of you actually have anything to do with this guy? And one of the fellows said, yeah, actually, he said, My job in prison is actually to look after these guys, give them tea and coffee, you know, twice a day or something. I say, marvellous. Now, I want you to make sure that when you make a cup of coffee or a cup of tea for that dog, to make sure it's the most delicious cup of tea or coffee you can possibly make. Put love into it. And when you give it to this guy, smile and be kind. He said, that's a tough thing to ask me. I said, look, do it. This is a test. So he did this, and I would go and visit them every week to teach them meditation. I always ask, how's it going? Look, it's a waste of time, Ajahn Brahm. I'm actually really trying because I respect you. Carry on. It took about 3 months. I think it was about 3 months. Or was it 6 months? But it's a long time when we got our breakthrough. And this is how he told it to me. I will never forget this. He said, he was really excited. He said, he never guessed what happened. He said, now I made a special cup of coffee. I got this real nice coffee, got some cream, you know, some, you know, honey, just like I know he likes. I've been watching him. And I gave him, here you are, sir, it's a really nice cup of coffee. Got some cream for you this time. And this prison officer, this dog, said, That's all, just, And he was so excited because that was the first time in about 3 or 6 months that that prison officer even acknowledged there was another being in the room. He'd actually grunted. And I knew, and I think they all got the message too, that that was our breakthrough. That was the crack in the wall. And it was only about a month later. And then they were really sort of, they all said, you win, Ajahn Brahm. I said, I don't win, it's just these teachings win. He said, because they had a cup of tea or something, and they got some special biscuits. I forget exactly the details of the story, but something like that. A special cup of tea, and they got his special biscuits. They managed to scrounge from somewhere. They presented it to the prison officer and said, here you are, sir. You know, we found these biscuits for you. I hope you enjoy your cup of tea. And the prison officer actually turned around and said, thank you. And the prisoners actually said to me, said, that thank you, it didn't just stay in Karnak Prison Farm. It went to all the prisons in the region, in West Australia, along the grapevine. It's a very powerful grapevine. I don't know how these things work, but they all know what's going on. And the very fact that that prison officer was well known for being one of the most difficult people, that he said thank you to a prisoner, was just unbelievable. It worked. You can turn a difficult person around, because they're not a difficult person, they're just a person who sometimes just relates to you with difficulty. But you can turn it around. And I challenge you to do that. It's a wonderful thing to do. Just number one, because it is hard work. It takes a lot of commitment. But when you actually do it and you find it can be done, that gives you, number one, a lot of hope for this world. A lot of hope for yourself. Because you can turn your own difficulties around to being a kind person, kind to yourself. But it also understands about a very important teaching of Buddhism. Just how you relate to the world. The karma which you put into things has enormous effect. You are not a victim. You don't have to be a victim. You can actually do it, you can actually change things. It takes effort, it takes skill. It takes a lot of faith as well to realize these things actually do work, and to encourage that faith, I want you to try these sorts of things. Find a difficult person and just keep being kind to them. That positive forgiveness. Don't focus on their faults. Focus on the other half of them. Even more than half. Until that's what they show you. Because what you look for is what you'll see. If you can do that to a difficult person in your office, maybe you can do it to your partner. I don't know how many times people have difficulties in their relationships and their marriages, going through divorces, separations and stuff like that. And it causes so much pain. And part of coming here is to lessen the pain of life. Now you know a way of doing that. Doesn't matter what your husband, what your wife has done. Just give them a cup of tea with their favourite biscuits and just say, no poison please. And just say, may you enjoy this, darling. I found your most favourite biscuits, a favourite coffee. Do that. And then you'll find this relationship changes. The difficulty goes. It takes time. But if it's your family, you haven't got much chance of doing anything. It's either that or just leaving each other. If it's real family, like husbands, like our parents, children, brothers and sisters, gee, I mean, you have to get together. You know, you're in this together. You can't really sort of divorce a brother or a sister or a parent. And if you're in a monastery or in a community, at least we should show by example that we can just forgive and focus on the kindness and the positiveness. And that way that we don't have difficulty with each other. And hopefully those of you who visit our monasteries, Nuns Monastery, Monks Monastery, or wherever, that you actually see that we can actually live together. And there's all sorts of people come into this place. Some have difficulty, some all sorts of problems. And hopefully that everyone is welcome. So there's no such thing as a difficult person. People with difficulties, and the other half of them, the other part of them, is what we focus on. Give them kindness. Because people have to live with each other, and they have to live with themselves. We can do something about this. And that's how we do it. How we live with difficult people. Easy. So, thank you for listening. So an hour's talk is gone already. And thank you for living with me every Friday evening. Okay, any comments or questions on that particular talk? Well, that's... Yes? That's John... Godman or... G-O-T-T-M-A-N, yeah. The reason I'm repeating this is for the tape. So you have to have three good vibes for every bad vibe to have a sustainable relationship at work or in a marriage or in a monastery or whatever. So what's a good vibe and what's a bad vibe?
Just basically what you're saying, loving kindness versus ill will.
Loving kindness is a good vibe. Forgiveness is a good vibe. Compassion is a good vibe. You pig is a bad vibe. Yeah. Ratios of 21. Ah, that's easy. I go for 100 to 1. Million to none. Actually, that's what you see. You have this beautiful relationship. The people which I have met, and being a monk, I'm very privileged to have met some incredible sort of beings. And again, these are beings who just don't have any ill will at all. They don't have bad vibes. You go around them, and you deserve lots of bad vibes, and the way you act to them, and the way you relate, but they just... don't give you anything back except kindness. Now, what I mentioned, was it last week that I said about the spikes? Remember the spike one? People don't have any spikes at all. Oh, it's just wonderful to be around such people. You can be whoever you are and you're totally loved and accepted. Even though you're an idiot, you're stupid, you've done terrible things. And it's so nice, it's just so freeing to be totally loved. And accepted by just a stranger. You're a human being, that's enough. That's 100% sort of good vibes, no bad vibes. I wish there were more people like that around. So thank you for that. So you're saying that what I've said is got the stamp of approval by modern psychology. Very good. Phew. That gives me a good vibe. Okay, so thank you for that comment.